This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kimarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 15th of October, as the US government gives Israel 30 days to improve access to humanitarian in Gaza or face having some US military support cut off. We get reaction from a member of the Israeli parliament, from the governing coalition, and from one of President Biden's ambassadors to Israel. On the eve of the assisted dying bill being introduced in parliament, we hear from the Archbishop of Canterbury and from the daughter of Tony Nicholinson, the man with locked-in syndrome who fought a very public campaign for the right to die. Plus, are North Korean soldiers helping the Russian war effort in Ukraine? And as former Chelsea boss Thomas Tuchel is confirmed as an England men's football manager, can a German end the decades of hurt? 30 days. That's how long the US Secretaries of State and Defense have given the Israeli government to boost humanitarian aid to Gaza or face potentially having some US military assistance cut off. That is the unusually stark choice, threat even, that's contained in a letter that was sent 2 days ago and made public today. In it, the two senior members of the Biden administration, Antony Blinken and Lloyd Austin, write that the US has deep concern about the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Gaza, adding that Israel denied or impeded nearly 90% of humanitarian movements between North and South Gaza last month. A failure to urgently reverse this trajectory, they continue, may have implications for US policy. And they cite laws which can prohibit military assistance to countries that impede the delivery of American aid. Matthew Miller is a spokesman for the US State Department. He explained why the letter had been sent.
What we have seen over the past few months is that the level of humanitarian assistance has not been sustained. In fact, it has fallen by over 50% from where it was at its peak. So the Secretary, along with Secretary Austin, thought it was appropriate to make clear to the government of Israel that there are changes that they need to make again to see that the level of assistance making it into Gaza comes back up from the very, very low levels that it is at today.
Well, the BBC's security correspondent Gordon Carrera is in Washington and joins us now. Gordon, this is a very detailed letter, isn't it?
It is. I think that's what's striking about it. I've got a copy in front of me. It was leaked, of course, but it has been confirmed by the State Department. And the conditions it sets out are very specific, enabling a minimum of 350 trucks per day to enter Gaza, for instance, talking about rescinding evacuation orders where there's no operational lead, waiving customs requirements, reaffirming there'll be no Israeli government policy of forced evacuation of civilians from northern to southern Gaza. So a mix of very specific demands about aid and wider policy demands that the US is making. And I think that level of detail is an indication that the US clearly does have concerns and is willing to express them quite forcefully in what was a private letter, we should say, but to the Israeli government in terms of that situation in Gaza.
Detailed in some respects, but potential consequences quite vague.
Yes, and I think that's one of the interesting things about it, is that it refers to provisions under the Foreign Assistance Act, where it's required that if the US is providing military assistance to a country, that they have to be abiding by certain conditions for humanitarian aid being allowed in. And so there is clearly a link there between humanitarian aid and military assistance, of which the US gives a considerable amount to Israel. But it's not quite an explicit threat that if these exact conditions are not met in 30 days, then there will be these specific consequences. The letter does not get into that kind of detail, we should say.
And it was sent, of course, on the same day that the US government was announcing it was deploying a high-altitude anti-missile system to defend Israel. So What do you make of the signals being sent by the letter and by that announcement?
No, I mean, you might see it as mixed signals or mixed messages, but I think the US would see it as operating on different levels, because effectively it's concerned about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, hence this letter. But it is also concerned about potential escalatory action between Israel and Iran and Iranian missiles hitting Israel and the consequences of that. And therefore, the missile defence is, if you like, on working on a slightly different level from this letter. And then equally in the State Department briefing, which took place a few hours ago, there was some questioning for the State Department spokesperson about the differences in the way the US saw the conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon. And so, for instance, in Gaza, there is a call for both parties to undertake a ceasefire agreement. There isn't quite the same call in Lebanon. There's a recognition there needs to ultimately be a diplomatic solution, but not that US pressure for a ceasefire now. So I think what you can see is the US effectively operating on different levels with different aspects of the Middle East crisis involving Israel, whether it's the relationship between Israel and Iran, between Israel and Lebanon, or the humanitarian situation in Gaza, and taking slightly different positions on all of those.
Gordon, many thanks. The BBC's Gordon Carrera in Washington. Well, the BBC and other news organisations are barred by Israel and Egypt from sending their correspondents into Gaza, but we do manage to speak to people inside the territory. Earlier today, the Today programme heard from Saib Alzad, who's close to the coast in northern Gaza, not far from the Jabalia refugee camp. And he explained what the food situation is like there.
The food problem is very bad, to be honest. Like, in this war, we miss all kind of natural food, if I can say that. Like, it's been a year without chicken or meat or like vegetables or fruit. It's so expensive if you saw it. So it's like you bear not to see it. I mean, in the market, you can find, for example, only one man who got meat, let's say, but like the price would be so expensive and he cannot sell it to anyone, only maybe like few person who can buy it from there. So it's you can see it's not found. We eat only food in cans, you know, but now also the cans are missed from the market. You can't find it, but thanks God we have bread. To get the bread, it was for us, it was a very big challenge. You could lose your life for getting a bread. And now we feel thankful that we have bread.
Saib Alzad speaking from northern Gaza. Simcha Rotman is a member of the Israeli parliament. He's from the Religious Zionist Party. That is part of Benjamin Netanyahu's governing coalition. The party is led by Bezalel Smotrich, who is Israel's finance minister. And he's one of the two ministers described today by the former foreign secretary, Lord Cameron, as extremists, whom he said he had considered sanctioning as a way of putting pressure on Israel to act within international law. I asked Simcha Rotman for his reaction to the US government letter.
I think there is a big problem of moral clarity as represents the administration position on the issue. Good and is evil.
When you say lack of moral clarity, what are you talking about? Because the letter is very specific about allowing humanitarian assistance into Gaza. Where
they're very specific, mm-hmm. but ignores reality. It's not true that there is no food in Gaza. This humanitarian aid that gets to Gaza is directly serving Hamas. Many trucks of humanitarian aid goes directly to Hamas.
Do you deny then that Israel has been blocking aid, which is what the Americans
yes.
are saying in this letter? You deny
yes.
that accusation?
I deny. Again, you're saying accusation, you're saying facts in the letter. I know from what the media said about the letter. I did not read the letter itself. I did not get the letter itself. But what I'm saying is that the accusation that Israel is preventing humanitarian aid when the amount of calories per person in Gaza, even now, is way more than the international standard, and Israel allows it. So, yes, I'm saying that anyone who is taking the wrong side of history on this fight between good versus evil has a problem with moral clarity.
So you're saying you cannot put humanitarian aid on one side and Hamas remaining in power on another side? You say
that
they are
linked. I'm saying that people try to make I'm saying that some people, for reasons that I don't understand, are trying to create a situation that Hamas will stay in control in Gaza. If this is the case, it's a terrible demand for human rights and humanitarian aid.
Can I just ask you about one more thing, sir, while we've got you? The former British Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, said today that he had had plans to sanction the leader of your party, Mr. Smotrich. What do you make of that?
Interfering in other countries' democratic process is not very democratic. The fact that the UK was funding through UNRWA and through some other entities the tunnels and the missiles and the terrorists that murdered our people, I would think in the UK and in other countries, people would think twice before criticizing anyone in Israel.
That was the Israeli Member of Parliament from the Religious Zionist Party, Simcha Rotman. Thomas Nides was appointed the US ambassador to Israel by President Biden, and he served in that role from December 2021 to July 2023. And I asked him what he made of the letter sent by those top US officials.
In the last 72 hours, we sent the most sophisticated defense system to the state of Israel to protect them for the potential oncoming assault from Iran. And we've been at Israel's back since the beginning of this conflict. The issue of the letter was directed at Israel as it relates to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And we have stated over and over and over again the importance of feeding people in Gaza. And I think over the last, you know, couple months, we've seen much of the humanitarian assistance come to a halt, or at least not as much as we believe it to be. So a little push is nothing to be worried about.
Is it a push that you welcome?
Well, of course. I believe full-heartedly that Israel has every right to defend itself. It has every right to destroy Hamas. It has every right to destroy Hezbollah. But they do have an obligation to feed innocent Gazans and innocent Palestinians. I think that's been the United States' position from the beginning of this war, and we continue to emphasize that.
It hasn't been until now, though, America's position to release a letter like this publicly, which contains within it the not veiled threat, but a real threat of implications on the military assistance front if Israel does not do something to reverse the situation within 30 days.
I think the letter was quite clear. We said that the need to increase humanitarian aid is urgent. I don't think there was a threat in the letter. I think it was clear that it does, in fact, put into discussions when Israel can't accomplish what I think we believe they can. So, again, the Israelis are smart.
Well, it quotes, sorry, Ambassador, just to put it into context, I mean, it quotes the State Department, it says, must conduct an audit and an evaluation in accordance with Section 620 of the Foreign Aid Programs Law in order to continue the aid military financing assistance to Israel. So it is linking the question of Israel allowing humanitarian aid to get through to American military assistance.
No question that the Israelis have an obligation, and given our laws, it's important for them to fulfill that. And quite frankly, I'm not in the government anymore, but I'm quite aware in previous months when we've put a little pressure on Israel vis-a-vis this issue, they've been able to do what they need to do.
So you would expect Israel to heed this letter and to do what is being requested, would you?
Israel wants to do the right thing. They have to get it done. We understand this is a war. We understand that the Israeli soldiers are being put in harm's way. We understand that Sinwar is a criminal. It is a terrorist. We understand all that.
What would you say then to a member of the Knesset we've spoken to from the Religious Zionist Party, which is one of the parties in Mr. Netanyahu's government, who says any attempt to give aid to Gaza at the moment is giving aid to Hamas. And actually, the Americans are essentially asking us, the Israelis, to allow Hamas to get more aid.
That's sad and unfortunate, because I think we all know this war is not with the Palestinian people. This war is not with the Gaza people. This war is with Hamas. That said, it's imperative for Israel, because it's a democratic country, to help people who cannot help themselves.
And if they don't follow this letter, I mean, does it have teeth?
You know, again, I'm not, Israel's smart. Again, as I remind you, we've got Israel's back.
And I just want to ask you about the timing of this. As you say, you're no longer in the administration, but this comes just a couple of weeks before a presidential election. Do you think this is in any way politically motivated? You know, there are lots of voices in the United States who are very upset and angry about the humanitarian situation. and this could have electoral consequences?
I think this administration has been pretty clear. Okay, our first objective is to protect the state of Israel. Our second objective is to make sure that innocent people are protected as best we can. I don't think those are values that the United States and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been articulating since the beginning of this war.
Thomas Nides, who served as U.S. ambassador to Israel from December 2021 to July 2023. Coming up later on in the programme, we'll hear from our correspondent in Kyiv about the reports that Russia is recruiting North Koreans to fight against Ukraine.
We have a source at the country's intelligence agency telling us that they suspect Russia is gathering around 3,000 North Korean soldiers, and they are expecting them to be deployed into Russia's Kursk region, where Ukraine staged this extraordinary incursion back in August.
More on that later on.
I'm Sumi Somaskander from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Tomorrow, a bill will be introduced in Parliament that would give terminally ill people in England and Wales the right to choose to end their lives. It marks the beginning of a parliamentary process that will address that most sensitive and morally fraught issue, the end of life. MPs will not begin to debate and vote on the Labour MP Kim Leadbeater's private members bill until the end of next month. But the debate is already taking place here on The World Tonight, where we have been hearing different views from listeners, from campaigners and from religious leaders. On Friday's programme, Cardinal Vincent Nichols, the most senior Catholic clergyman in England and Wales, told Sean why he had urged Roman Catholics to write to their MPs opposing assisted dying legislation. He argued that the right to die could quickly become a duty to die.
I believe if this law becomes permitted, passed, then inevitably at times we will look at each other in a different way. We will look at each other and think, oh, I wonder if this doctor really had something else in mind. I wonder whether my children are looking at me in my old age in a slightly different way. Because a law which permits very quickly becomes a law which encourages.
Cardinal Vincent Nichols there. Well, in a moment, we're going to hear from the daughter of a prominent campaigner on this issue, a man who had locked-in syndrome and who spent years fighting for the right to allow doctors to end his life. First, though, the view of the head of the Church of England. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has been sharing his views on assisted dying with the BBC's religion editor, Ali McBull.
My position overall on assisted suicide is, in one respect, exactly the same as Kim Leadbeater and those who are advocating this, which is to start with compassion for those who are suffering. On that, we are totally agreed. But I think this approach is both dangerous and sets us in a direction which is even more dangerous than in every other place where it's been done, has led to a slippery slope every other place.
What is it in faith, perhaps even in scripture, that leads you to feel that way about assisted dying?
It is the sense of the dignity of each human being, that every human being is of infinite worth, especially for those with learning difficulties and that kind of area. We now in society treat them as of equal importance to everyone else. We don't hide them away, thank God, particularly towards the end of life. And also with disabilities, we see that the natural instinct of society is to overlook people. You don't have to coerce and abuse people to make them feel that they are a burden, not someone of great worth who is treasured. I remember 18 months ago, when my mum was at the end of her life, at a good old age, very bright, full of life, And a little while before she died, my wife and I were with her, and she said, "I must be such a burden." And we immediately said, I said, "Mum, you're not a burden, you're a treasure. Every day with you is a gift." But it's easy at that point to say, "Oh, well, I expect I can cope." And just by not denying someone's a burden, particularly when people are towards the end of their life, you reinforce in their minds the ideas that they are.
We heard at Synod a couple of years ago the story
indeed
of Val Plum, whose mother had been a churchgoer all her life, wasn't afraid of death, but asked to be put out of her misery because she was in so much pain at the end.
The answer to that is, Wes Streeting quite rightly said very recently, when he was expressing not opposition but caution about this kind of legislation, he said the problem we've got is that our, I'm not quoting him exactly, is that our palliative care and hospice care are not yet in a strong enough place to give good alternatives. So I am certain that it's not that God is not saying, "I want X to have an intolerably painful death." But I am also certain that over 30 years of pastoral care, I've seen so many cases where there has not been adequate support for the person. I remember many, many years ago when my dad was very ill. I remember there was a burden. I was a late teens. It was a hugely pressurized time. I remember, to be honest, hoping that he would die soon. I know that feeling.
Just a couple of years ago, when Synod voted on this, only 7% of people supported a change in the law on assisted dying. That is quite considerably out of kilter with society as a whole.
Yes.
Is that another reason that people will feel that the church is out of step with society and might push them away?
It might. I mean, at the moment, the church is growing quite rapidly across the country, all churches, not just one part of it, not just the Church of England. Numbers are going up. So, yes, there will be people who look at that and say, "This is totally out of touch and I totally disagree and I'm not going near the church." But we don't do things on the basis of opinion polls. Incidentally, just to correct that, the very large majority for assisted suicide, when they hear the arguments, drops to about 50-50, 47-53, I think it is to be
exact. Still an awful lot more than 7%.
It's an awful lot more than 7%, but the church doesn't act for popularity. We act in this sort of situation out of deep love and compassion and awareness of dangers to the intrinsic human dignity and value of every individual, whoever they are.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, speaking to our religion editor, Aleem McBull. Let's hear another view now. Tony Nicholson was a very prominent assisted dying campaigner. After a stroke in 2005, he had locked-in syndrome, a neurological condition which left him completely paralysed and unable to communicate verbally. He campaigned for a change in the law that would allow doctors to end his life, but the High Court rejected his case in 2012, just days before he died. The BBC's Victoria Derbyshire met him in 2011. He spoke to her using a computer which tracked his eyeball movements and converted them into sentences. The words you're about to hear are Tony's, although it is not his voice. Here he is describing his condition 6 years after suffering that stroke, which left him paralysed from the neck down.
"I cannot make myself understood. I cannot move to make myself comfortable. The carers do their stuff because they remind me of the independence I no longer have. I cannot eat without coughing. I have to eat baby food because I cannot chew. I have to forego all my favorite foods for the same reason. There are a thousand reasons why having locked-in syndrome is frustrating, too many to mention here. Just imagine if you can your worst nightmare and then make it worse and you're nowhere near it. To those people who say that I should be grateful I still have my life, I would reply that they should try locked-in syndrome and then see if they are still grateful they have life. It is made even worse when the sufferer has an active and functioning mind, because the only thing you can do is to think. I sometimes think it would be better to have brain damage so that thinking is impossible. When the right to determine where, when and how a person dies is taken away just because that person needs help is a serious matter, and the reasons why it is necessary should be closely examined.
Tony Nicholson speaking to the BBC in 2011. I've been speaking to his daughter, Lauren Peters. She's one of the signatories of a letter which is calling for the new legislation to include not just the terminally ill, but also those suffering unbearably. And she began by remembering the moment that her father lost his case in the High Court in 2012.
I honestly believe that if he'd won, he would have lived longer because he knew he had a get out, but we didn't win. And so, yeah, a few days later, he died of pneumonia, having refused treatment and all food and drink. We've done as much campaigning as we can around the issue, and it's still hugely important to us as a family. I really want to urge politicians to think really bravely and broadly about the issue right now, rather than taking the approach of let's start small and just do something to support one segment of society. No, now's the time to think about everyone and everyone's needs and how we can make it possible for all of them.
Where do you think the line needs to be drawn?
We've always wanted this to be about individual choice and autonomy. So for us, it's always historically been about dad and his needs, but now he's not here. It's about what people want as individuals. There would have to be regulations that would protect people, and there would have to be processes in place that make sure that people have tried everything possible to live a full and happy life. But you will always get people like Dad who did try everything possible and it just wasn't enough for him. So where that line is drawn, I don't know yet, but I do think it's possible to find that line. Absolutely.
We've spoken on this programme tonight to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and one of the issues he raised was his concern that every life would not be treated the same, that people who were disabled or had learning difficulties, somehow their lives would be seen as second class. This is not clearly something that applies to your father, but I mean, what do you say to that kind of concern being raised?
Every concern is a valid concern. I'm not going to dismiss anyone's fears or concerns or worries on the matter. It's hugely sensitive and it's hugely emotional. And, you know, the idea that anyone's life would be classed as second class because of their disabilities or even any learning disabilities is really upsetting. And that isn't absolutely how we feel, and that isn't what we would want. You know, for instance, you'd have to be of sound mind. You'd have to be absolutely coherent in expressing these wishes and taking the journey you needed to get to the end. So whether or not someone with learning disabilities would be eligible, I don't know. I don't know what the boundaries and where the lines would be yet, but it's about choice. You know, you could argue that at the moment, people like Dad are treated as second-class citizens because they haven't got the rights of the able-bodied, in that they can't, like Dad couldn't end his life if he wanted to in the way that I could right now if I wanted to. So by doing this, it's about giving people fair choice. It's about giving everyone the same rights. It is hugely emotional. No one's denying that. But no one's life is worth more than anyone else's.
You said an interesting thing, that you believe your father might have lived longer if he had won the case and knew there was a get out. It's about peace of mind, is it, as well as the here and now of someone who's made a decision that they want to end their life. It's having that ability, or knowing you have that ability to make that decision without any consequences for your loved ones.
Absolutely. I know from, you know, doing my reading, a lot of people who are going to Dignitas have to go a lot sooner than they would like to, because they need to be able to physically get there themselves without the support of family members, because if family members take them, then they're at risk of prosecution. So if people have the right and they can then die at home in their own bed where they're comfortable, they can probably live longer. And I think for Dad, it was a safety net. It was knowing that when things got really, really bad, he would have had a way out. And for him, when we lost the High Court, things were really, really bad because he saw no future, and hence why he refused medical treatment and died of pneumonia, which is not a particularly pleasant way to go. What people forget is that often when you give people the chance to die, you give them the energy to live again.
What do you think he would have made of
this being debated? How would he have wanted his voice to be heard, do you think?
He would have seen it as an opportunity, not the only approach. So he would have, I guess, been taking the route that I am, which is encouraging people to think much more broadly rather than just supporting the terminally ill, which is one segment of society. He would encourage everyone not to forget him and the people in his position and the people in his position who would want this. So those with unbearable and incurable suffering. So the irony is he couldn't speak, but he would have been incredibly vocal about this and he would have done everything he could to get people to sit up and listen. And obviously in his absence, that's what we're doing instead.
Lauren Peters, daughter of the late Tony Nicholinson, that bill introduced to Parliament tomorrow. We will continue hearing views on this issue on The World Tonight. They chanted his name and they gave him a rousing reception. That was the warm welcome President Putin received during his visit to North Korea earlier this year, a trip he used to sign a mutual defence pact with his North Korean counterpart. Well, now there are reports from Kyiv that Kim Jong-un is helping the man he has called his closest comrade by sending him several thousand comrades in arms, North Koreans who are reportedly being trained to fight alongside Russian soldiers on the battlefield. The US State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said that would mark a new low for the Kremlin.
We are concerned by the reports of DPRK soldiers fighting on behalf of Russia. If that's true, it would mark a significant increase in the relationship between those two countries, the relationship that you have seen develop over the past several months. It would also indicate a new level of desperation by Russia as it continues to suffer significant casualties on the battlefield.
James Waterhouse is the BBC correspondent in Kyiv, and he told me what is known about North Korea's military ties with Russia.
I think the only thing we can say with certainty on this one is that the relationship between Moscow and Pyongyang is only deepening. Now, we have Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un clink wine glasses earlier this year. They signed an agreement to help each other out. We know there is mounting evidence that North Korean missiles and artillery shells have been used by invading forces here in Ukraine. And now we have a source at the country's intelligence agency telling us that they suspect Russia is gathering around 3,000 North Korean soldiers close to its border with Mongolia, thousands of miles from here, and they are expecting them to be deployed into Russia's Kursk region, where Ukraine staged this extraordinary incursion back in August. Now, no evidence has accompanied this claim, but clearly, you know, this would mark a real development in how Russia is supported by North Korea. And there were real concerns here in Kyiv that that number, albeit small in a battlefield sense, could grow.
Sending 3,000 North Korean soldiers to Kursk, on the face of it, seems odd, to put it mildly. What would the thinking behind that be?
It's a numbers game, Jamie. In this confrontational war, in its crudest sense, this is about Russia trying to make its size count. And this is something that plays to Ukraine's weakness. Now, we know when Russia mobilized convicts, when it emptied prisons in some areas and sent them to the front line, there was an issue there in terms of having to train them sufficiently. On the Ukrainian side, we see that with the International Legion, for example, where you have language barriers. The reports are suggesting that these North Korean soldiers have been provided with small arms. And if they are sent in, you wonder what their role will be or how effective they can be. But nevertheless, we're talking about an area where Russia is looking to repel Ukraine from its own territory. And they'll certainly be used in that endeavour. But we are, we must emphasise that we are talking about a relatively small number for now.
Yes, because in propaganda terms, it's hard to see how this would be a win for President Putin to have to get foreign soldiers in to retake the part of Russian territory that is being occupied by the Ukrainians.
Absolutely, and I think this is why we're seeing the Kremlin be, very quickly deny these claims. We've seen comments from Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman. I think this is a possible symptom of the losses Russia has sustained. Ukraine has suffered also more acutely, but clearly, if you know, the agreement that Moscow and Pyongyang signed, it was worded along the lines of agreeing to help each other if either was on the receiving end of aggression. And I think what we're seeing is North Korea provide military help in exchange for economic ties. But I think for Vladimir Putin privately, this is a strategic relationship as much as anything else. But, you know, to answer your point, it's not a great look in a propaganda sense.
BBC's James Waterhouse in Kyiv. They don't just think it's all over. It really is. The wait, that is, to find out who'll become the full-time successor to Gareth Southgate. It's been confirmed this evening that the former Chelsea, Paris Saint-Germain and Bayern Munich manager Thomas Tuchel will be the third non-Briton to manage the England men's football team and the first since 2012. Under the Southgate leadership, of course, England reached two Euros finals and a World Cup semi-final. So could a German who has had Champions League success with an English club be the man to end the long wait by England's men for another major trophy? Well, let's speak to freelance football writer Henry Winter. He's been watching the England's under-21 side beat Azerbaijan 7-0 in Bristol this evening. Good evening, Henry.
Good evening, Jamie.
Of course, Lee Carsley, the coach of the under-21s, has been filling in for the time being in the main team. What do you make of the Thomas Tuchel appointment, though?
Well, he's a winner. As you say, he won the Champions League with Chelsea 2021. He obviously loathes a lot of the players. He took Harry Kane to Bayern Munich. He's a winner. He's a perfectionist. He's an elite coach. It's interesting talking to some England fans earlier in the day. They were saying, have you got an issue with a German coach? And with luck, this will be the end of that daft 10 German bombers chant. And they were saying, we don't care if he gets England over the line, if he makes big decisions, big calls at decisive moments. And, if he has to call out one or two of the egos and say, you're not starting because it's better for the balance of the team, then so be it. England got an exceptional generation of players. It just needs a manager just to get them over the line.
Yeah, well, interesting the point you're making about fan culture. But in terms of the players, I mean, great record, Southgate, but not quite over the line. What sort of team would you say he is taking over?
It's like a fantastic jigsaw. You can just see it forming. It's just we haven't got anyone to actually put all the bits in the right order. And I think Tuchel has shown he can do that. Look, he will fall out with people. He will fall out with players because he's so absolutely demanding. He will fall out with sort of people like me in the media. There's always, with Tuchel, there's always a sort of slight Taylor Burton element. You know, he's in love with his club, then he falls out of love with the club, then he falls back in, then he gets sacked, and it's all, it's all a bit of a nightmare. So, it will be very, very lively. There will be fireworks, but the players will respond because they know that he's an elite level coach. And after sort of the nonsense of Lee Carsley's formation that he chose with a false nine when he had two real number nines on the bench against Greece last Thursday at Wembley, you need a proper elite coach in there, and Thomas Tuchel certainly that.
And you mentioned Harry Kane, obviously not at the beginning of his career, but he got a fantastic season out of him last season at Bayern Munich, didn't he? I mean, do you think he can just bring those elite players up a notch?
Yes, but he'll also challenge Harry Kane. He'll say, listen, you're England's leading goal scorer, you're a fabulous player, you're England's captain, but you need to raise your game a little bit more. And maybe he'll put a little bit more pace around him to bring the best out of Harry Kane. But, you can't be in the England team with a sinecure, which Harry Kane maybe under one or two managers might have had. But Tuchel won't have that. He will absolutely demand. He'll play players on form. And if Harry Kane's not delivering, then Ollie Watkins or Dominic Solanke or maybe Liam Delap long term will step up.
Some names of the future there and some from the present. Henry, many thanks for that analysis. Football writer Henry Winter there on the prospects of the New England men's football manager, Thomas Tuchel. Our closing headline tonight, the United States has told Israel it may withhold some military assistance unless the provision of aid into Gaza is improved within 30 days. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.